Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. Before we start this week's episode of Nexium on Trial, I wanted to take a moment to note that the paper's investigative coverage of Keith Raniere and his organization was supported primarily by ART subscribers, whose readership paid the salaries of reporters, copy editors, and digital designers, as well as the lawyers who provided the good counsel that made our work bulletproof against this highly litigious group. If you subscribe to the Times Union, thanks. If you don't, please consider supporting our watchdog reporting. Without you, the truth might never come to light.
If you're enjoying Nexium on Trial, be sure to check out its sister podcast, The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall, host of The Eagle. Each week, we'll take a look inside the newsroom at the Times Union, the Capital Region's oldest and largest newspaper. We'll discuss the week's top stories, and we'll talk to the award-winning reporters who write them. Listen at timesunion.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union, welcoming you to another episode of Nexium on Trial, a podcast about the strange case of Keith Raniere and his acolytes in a purported self-improvement organization that was brought down by federal prosecutors in 2017. In just a moment, we'll be joined by criminal justice reporter Rob Gavin and two very special guests, Sarah Edmondson and her husband Anthony Ames, known as Nippy. Edmondson was one of the former Nexium insiders who in 2017 alerted the public and law enforcement officials to the existence of a master-slave sex cult within Nexium that had Raniere, the man known as Vanguard, at the top of the hierarchy. Edmondson's journey out of Nexium formed the spine of HBO's ongoing documentary series, The Vow, and is chronicled in her own 2019 memoir, Scarred. She and her husband are launching a new podcast titled A Little Bit Culty. And with that, I will hand things off to Rob Gavin. Rob, go ahead.
Thanks, Casey. It's always good to be here. And I want to also welcome Sarah and Nippy to the podcast. Great to have both of you as part of this, especially now because, and you are about to have your own podcast coming up, and it's got a very, very memorable name. It's called A Little Bit Culty. What can you tell us about this? And I am eager to listen.
Well, you know, apparently we're just not done talking about this. And we were actually approached by some former members of a fundamentalist church group who make podcasts. And they said, you know, you should do one. And we were like, oh, man, everyone's got a podcast these days, yourself included, Rob. And, you know, and then they were like, well, you know, podcasts are kind of like websites these days. And people, it's become more niche. And we think that people have more to ask. And we... It's true, like even though The Vow really covered everything and my book as well, people still had questions and we still feel, and we've always felt that this was obviously a really terrible thing that happened, but it also, we believe in turning a negative into a positive, and the silver lining is that we are now unofficial experts in the field and we wanna help people. We were trying to help people before, obviously we bet on the wrong horse with Nexium and we were conned there with the falsehood of personal growth, but personal growth, yeah, it was gross actually. And we still want to help people. So now this is our way of educating and healing and all the things from, you know, how to spot the red flags and the narcissism to how to get out, how to help family members. We just want to keep talking about this and share our nuggets of wisdom. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, I just to all that you just said and. You know, I'd been in the journey of just saying no to everything. I kind of wanted this whole thing to end. And people kept having questions for us and there was a demand for it. Frankly, this thing was over for me kind of when the convictions happened in June of 19. And then The vow came out and kind of had to relive it a little bit. And I was kind of ready to put it to bed. And I was shocked at the outpouring. I was shocked at the support and really just the overall interest in it, past the salacious aspect of it. And then we polled some people, and the response was overwhelming because they had more questions and it didn't stop. And then finally, you know, the people that approached us were like, we can put this in your room, in your bedroom during COVID. And I was like,
living room.
Yeah, living room. Sorry.
That'd be awkward.
And they're literally going to bring it to us. And, you know, I'm having conversations with a lot of friends and family about it anyway. I figured why not, you know, put it on a platform where people can turn our story into some wisdom.
Are you expecting that that you'll have guests, and will those guests within the orbit of Nexium or in potentially other situations where people have been drawn into kind of charismatic cults as well?
Both. So all that.
One
other thing, and I'll have to ask you guys right now. First of all, we have experts, and we're not calling them victims. We're calling them winners
or survivors.
Survivors. You know, we're coming up. We want to come up with a better word. And then we were actually thinking of going through, if there's an interest or demand for it, some of the curriculum and how the indoctrination works. You know, because we still have our hands on some of the curriculum. We're going to go through, you know, how you end up wearing a sash, how you end up doing these things, you know, and how the parallels to society of, you know, judges have robes and stuff like this, rules and rituals and other aspects of the curriculum we're going to take people through just to give people a sense of how it works. We're not sure if we're going to do that yet, but we'll see. We might test one and see
what the response is. So far, we've been focusing on talking to guests. I think we can share that we were talking to Stephen Hassan, who you probably know. And he wrote Combating Cult Mind Control, which was really helpful for us. We've spoken to Yanya Lalich, another cult expert. Okay. And then we've also we've gone beyond the sphere of Nexium, although we do plan on speaking to former members. We're talking to Susan Dones next week. And hopefully Mark, when he's ready, I know he's in healing mode right now. But we also spoke to Leah Remini from Scientology, and we're speaking to Mike Rinder from Scientology tomorrow. So we are just like, we're just trying to, you know, expand the circle, share the knowledge. And I'll tell you, speaking to Leah, and I've also spoken on their podcast, Mike and Leah's, it's like finding allies in this field is very healing. It's very supportive. It feels like, wow, okay, now I'm back on a purposeful existence path, which feels really good.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that, you know, we talk about former members, current members. And before we met this morning, I was on Twitter, and it just seems every time I'm on Twitter, there's that one part of Twitter where I'll see a tweet and I'll see the name of a former member of Nexium on there who's still loyal to Keith Raniere. And there has been this group, I've written about them, that call themselves, you know, the quote unquote Dossier Project. I know I've reported and we've heard about former members of Nexium and DOS, which as we all know was called The Vow, that danced outside Keith Raniere's prison last summer. But they've since gone public calling themselves, it's very bizarre because they say they're former members of DOS, but there's a website for this Dossier Project. And they just days ago issued a press release on this, you know, their 10-point manifesto. I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's something that, you know, particularly now with The Vow being out, with, you know, it was obviously Seduced was out. There's other things coming on about Nexium. And they're just still riding the Keith Raniere was wrongly accused train there. Mm-hmm. But what do you think when you see them put these things out? And obviously, you know, some of the people involved, Nikki Klein, the former Battlestar Galactica actress, who you know, was a very high-ranking member of DOS, was in there as well. What's your take on this when you see that? Because they mentioned things in there about how you came forward, and that you know, I've reported when you spoke to us, I thought you were very specific, and it was I think a very powerful statement to hear how you went to the FBI, and they basically nobody did anything about it. And here you have former members of DOS. Now, which I find kind of amazing, all of a sudden now they're saying, well, you know, look, the feds didn't see anything there. So now at this point, Keith Raniere supporters are now giving credibility to the federal government, which I find kind of amazing.
So, when it serves them, the FBI are credible. Or when it doesn't serve them, they're corrupt. So
when you look at this, what's your feeling? What's your take on that?
All right, first.
Nippy's going to go first, and I have a longer answer.
Desperation is a stinky cologne, right? And that's what we're looking at right there. And I'd also like to say it doesn't feel good for Sarah and I to see people that we used to know in this place. But all that said, it's a major insult to everyone's intelligence, number one. It's an insult to the systems that we have in place to hold people accountable. It's an insult to you guys' profession who reports on this. And more importantly, it's an insult to a volume of victims and people who have been through trauma, pain, and whatever they have to do to maintain their narrative. They delete all that stuff and they maintain it's the world not understanding Keith Raniere rather than them. If they do a simple YouTube Google search or read 30 to 60 pages of Yanya Yalaj's book, they'll find the patterns of abuse that were put on them. And they're basically people that have been spiritually raped, calling it personal growth. So their process is one where anytime they get information that conflicts with their narrative, they double down on their narrative. They're not interested in the truth. They're interested in pushing their narrative forward. They spend most of their time dividing the word of truth. They do it through loaded language. I watched a little bit of Daniel Roberts' thing on Dateline the other day. She's like, there's a difference between harming someone in pain. Maybe, but on a Venn diagram, they look a lot alike and they overlap alike. And basically what they're talking about is they're not able to take in the fact that the physical abuses that went on with all these people were a manifestation of all the emotional abuses that have been going on for years. So they're not strong enough to pivot to reality. And somehow they think they're immune to all the things that everyone else that left has had to go through, which is, you know, their lives have been turned upside down. They bet on something wrong. They have to reconcile their delusion. And somehow they think they don't have to go through that. And somehow they think they're immune to the abuses that were going on. So seeing all that and understanding what's going on with them probably better than they understand, is hard to do. But when they attack my wife and they out her, that's when I feel like I have to say something. I'm reluctant to give them a platform. I think giving them a platform only emboldens them a little bit. Cause if you look at their process, they basically just identify a group of people or a domain of people that are disenfranchised. You know, they never cared about prisoners before, yet they're dancing outside of prison and twerking for Keith outside of prison, claiming that they're champions for prisoners. Then they hitch their wagon to We Are As You.
Black Lives Matter.
They hitch their wagons to all these disenfranchised groups and in the process abuse those groups while pretending to champion their cause. So it's a typical playbook of Keith Raniere. Starts these companies, assumes anoints themselves morally superior. And when you're drunk on moral superiority, you're immune to facts. And the facts are, overwhelmingly, there's a Mount Everest of information that this guy is a narcissistic sociopath. And all you have to do is look at Yanya Yalaj's 15 traits of a sociopath, and you might change your perspective. But since they reject all that information, they're rendered to wherever they're rendered to. And as long as you're hitched to Keith Raniere, you know, it's not going to end well for you. Look at his wake. So all that said, you know, I don't want to give them any more attention. I think it'll fade. But when they talk about my wife, I kind of feel like I need to say something because I'm kind of tired of it.
Sarah, of course, yes. Obviously, your thoughts.
Yeah, I have a lot. And echo everything that Nippy says as well, that we were torn between ignoring them because it's just so delusional. I don't want to add any fuel to that fire. But I actually messaged with Leah Remini about it because I didn't know what to do. And she was like, well, you know, people are looking to you to see what your response is going to be for something like this, even though really nobody's reading that going, maybe DOS is a good thing. And maybe branding is the way to build character. And maybe Sarah's a big fat liar. You know, nobody's doing that. This is just to fortify the few remaining followers to keep them going and to fortify their narrative. But I guess the things, you know, following that idea that that people are looking to us for a response, it's very clear. And I agree with what Nippy said. Like, when I see that and I see them dancing, I mean, I fluctuate a little bit between being like wanting to pick them up and slap them across the face and say, wake up. This is ridiculous. Move on with your life. It's over. It is over. Like, we were wrong. You were wrong. Eat the shit sandwich we've all eaten. Admit the truth and move on. I know that's not the way to it. I know that I can't reach them because they hate me because I destroyed the community and all that stuff, which I get. But I also feel sad. Like, you know, Nikki was at our wedding. Mark Elliott was at our wedding. Everyone that is still loyal, I know, except for Sunil. I have no relationship with Sunil. I feel so bad for him. He was just this lost young man with no social circle, and he got caught up in a fight. And anyway, we can talk about that later. But in terms of the dossier project, I guess my key points, and to be honest, I didn't read the whole thing. I've got two kids and it doesn't deserve my time. But from what I did read, the first thing that caught my mind is they said that I spoke out and it was my false narrative. And to that, I would say, let's just say that's true. I made it all up. I'm a big fat liar. My narrative is totally false. Let's take Sarah's testimony out of the equation. What about all the other women? What about all three Fernandez sisters and what Keith did to them? All of them getting pregnant, all of them having abortions.
The text messages.
And like, then I go to Danielle Roberts, who I also watched her brief interview on Dateline. I mean, you can see the indoctrination in her face. She cannot speak truthfully and wrap her head around all these things, all these lies they have to uphold and all the justifications to make it okay. I mean, I think down in her soul, she's a good person and her head got messed
with.
They all are. Yeah. But specifically her point that the women wanted it. The women wanted it. Do you think I wanted Keith's initials on my body? Maybe she did because she was in love with Keith. Everyone in the top line, all the DOS line slaves, all those 8-9 women, you probably know better than me, they were all in love with Keith. And okay, so they want to put his initials on their body? Great. Go for it. As soon as you start bringing in married women, I'm in love with my husband. I don't want Keith's initials on my body. The women wanted it. There's proof. There's proof of Keith saying to Allison, tell the women that they should say, Master, would you brand me? It would be an honor.
Like a sacrifice,
and to make it look consensual. It's all laid out. So like, here's the thing. It's sad because I remember that perspective because I used to be in it. I was in it when the Times Union did their expose and it was so damning and so awful, but I couldn't even consider that to be true because I'd been indoctrinated for so long. Keith had already prepped us to say, when you're as noble as we are and trying to put good out in the world, there's going to be pushback. And what's the worst thing they could say about somebody like me? Oh, what's the worst thing? I'm a pedophile. I'm a rapist. That speaking with dishonor will forever be in the minds of the readership. And so when that came out, he'd already predicted it. And we're like, of course they're going to say that about him. Of course. I couldn't even take it in. And by the way, thank you for doing that. All of you at the Times Union, you guys are a very important part of this story. And I apologize for not believing it. I don't even think I read it. Like, I heard about it and then somebody told me not to read it because it would alter my quote thought object of Keith.
And so, you're referring to the 2012 series.
2012, yeah.
Which was, that's the good work of Jim Odato and Jen Gish and the people who supported that journalism. Yeah, and I mean, in watching The Vow, I think it was Mark Vicente who sort of addressed the release of that story and said, boy, I found it really disturbing, but I talked to Keith and he just completely talked me down. And I can tell you when I was watching that episode, it made me want to pick up my television set.
I'm sure. I mean, I wish I'd asked more questions, but you have to understand, first of all, I'm from Vancouver, so
we weren't there.
The paper wasn't here. And then when I heard about this smear campaign, I was upset. Like, how dare these people try to, you know, speak so dishonorably about somebody who's clearly so good. And keep in mind, I had seen nothing personally to make any of that make sense. So it just fortified the narrative that the world is out to get Keith.
Well, that's an important distinction too. Like, the people that are loyal are indoctrinated differently. It's case by case. You know, if you moved to Albany, you lived around Keith, you were indoctrinated differently than people that were peripheral. So I think it's one of the things that allowed for me to be as outraged as I was. You know, these behaviors hadn't been normalized to me at all. They never would have been. And another, I think, point too is almost every one of the people that are still indoctrinated and loyal have had a family member or friend reach out to us asking us for help with them. I'm pretty sure none of my friends and family are calling them and asking them for help
for us
to see Keith for who he really is.
Yeah. You know,
so they're alone. They're alone in this, and I don't think they have much to go back to, and they've doubled down on their bet. So it's tough. And I was driving this morning and I was thinking of Amy Winehouse. You know, everyone put a camera on her and watched that train wreck just crash. And I kind of feel like this is, obviously it's not substance, but it's a different kind of equity that they have in believing this. And I think if you leave them alone, they'll figure it out on their own.
Have you found that it's something in different groups, different cults, where that is also the case, where you have a leader telling people, don't believe, you know, the people who are the fact checkers, whether it's the news media or whether it's the federal government, or the FBI. Is that something that you found?
Yeah, 100%. That is,
they control information.
There's
It's part of Stephen Hassan's book. It's called The Bite Model. And if you have any group that can attempts to control your behavior, the information, your thoughts or emotions, look out.
Yeah.
It's like a colander of some kind. Yeah. You're going to see this through my eyes, because if you look at it through someone else's, obviously they were to reveal, would have read and look at this stuff. Yeah, you could have a different perspective, obviously.
And everyone believed that to a certain extent. I think the more peripheral you were to this organization, you were literally in a goals program in Vancouver and another city, and you check in once a week with your coach. But the closer you got to Keith, that's where it got more dangerous.
I was going to say, the higher you went in NXIVM, Keith wanted you in Albany, right? Or when we say Albany, we mean like the Clifton Park area. We mean, obviously, Knox Woods taking classes at 455 New Corner Road. But is that true that the higher you went in NXIVM, Keith would want you closer to him?
Oh, yeah.
It was suggested.
No, we were every time I saw him towards the end, we were getting pressure to move there. And Keith would be like, you know, and ultimately, I had my green card. I was making the motions to make it look like that, but I never wanted to go. Don't get me wrong, I love certain aspects of Albany. It's very pretty, and I love Sarah, you know, the whole, but it's very dark to me now. Like I hope I never have to go back, because it's just so laden with these awful memories. But I didn't want to move. My family's here, my career's here. And I think intuitively, I'd go there, and everyone was so morose, and all the women were like sickly and thin. And, you know, so even though I couldn't quite wrap my head what was going around, it's like going on, I didn't want to be in that. You know, I wanted the tools, I wanted the curriculum, but I didn't want to live there.
So Robert, I have a story for you here.
Sure.
I found out on a Friday over the phone about what happened to Sarah. And I was in New York City, and we were planning what we were going to do about it. You know, once I heard that, all the things about Keith started to make sense to me. And everything that I had kind of a doubt about became true. So I kind of recognized immediately, almost in an instant, what I was dealing with, from a guy who was misunderstood to a guy who's mentally deranged. And I was scared, because I didn't know, you know, what I was, I didn't know what to do about that. And so fortunately we had a lot of, you know, it was myself, Mark and Bonnie, we made a lot of really good decisions in a short amount of time. But I remember they didn't know I knew. And I went up to Albany, and I was owed money. So, and I basically, and I had a relationship with Lauren where I felt like, I just said, Lauren, listen, I can't do anything right now. I need money. So I got paid what I was owed. And that was mostly money that I put up to run my own trainings beforehand. I was supposed to be reimbursed by. And so I decided to go to Albany, and I go to a volleyball to kind of see like what I can ascertain and see. And I start talking to Lauren about Mark. She hasn't talked to Mark since he's left. And I just want to get her assessment of it. I know the truth. And she says to me something, I'll never forget this. We're at volleyball. She's like, he's been asking questions about how the women are losing weight, and they're looking six. And he's like, and I'm like, do you not trust Keith? I'm like, this is what growth looks like. You're in your shit. You're in Albany. It sucks. We're like, blah, blah, blah. And she started going on about how I go, that's not what growth is. In my mind, I'm going, that's not what growth is. Some of the best years of my life, I was growing and I was going through things. Growth is fun. You know, obviously, you know, finding out you're wrong about things can sting, but like the process of growth feels good. It builds your self-esteem. And that was a major, like, and that was like the dogma of the people in Albany. Like, yes, it sucks here and all that stuff, but we're working harder. And I just saw that's the psychology that I felt like I had always been adverse to and why I never wanted to really go close to the epicenter of the stuff, because the psychology didn't resonate with me. It wasn't positive. But I remember they were all kind of drunk on that psychology. And you can kind of see that now. They load their language with stuff like that. And I can hear, like I heard in Danielle's Dateline thing, she's like, there's a difference between harm and pain. That's them dividing the word of truth. She's like, I'm sad that they chose to perceive it that way. As though abuse is something you can choose, to perceive a certain way. Like, you're being abused, but I'm not. You're perceiving it that way. So that's a choice. No,
gaslighting.
They're victims too. So, you know, that's when I say it's an insult to people's intelligence, because they have one narrow perspective. We all have the systemic
big picture.
And they keep pushing a narrative for that just won't gain traction. And it's confusing to me as to who they think they're talking to.
Wow.
Can I add something about the big picture?
Sure.
Just so you understand the perspective, like when we were in it and you guys were, you know, writing articles and clearly we were a cult and all that stuff, if you were to break down all the things that were weird, the sashes, the bowing, the call, every one of those things had a reasonable answer. Like, we wear sashes, like in karate, this is a representation of the level we're at. And we call Keith Vanguard because it's calling the judge your honor. It's just a title.
Or instead of president.
You know, and everything has a totally rational explanation. And for them, you know, women get branded just like in sororities. You know, it's just a commitment. You know, every single one of those things you can brush off like that. They haven't had the chance to rest, recuperate, be away from Keith and the indoctrination, to pull back and see the big picture, see the whole thing and go, oh my God, this is messed up. They can't. And they can't because it goes against all the time and energy they put into it, the money, the trainings, their reputation. They just keep having to fortify, we are good people, we did the right thing. The whole world doesn't understand. But the thing that does, you know, if I could plant a seed for them, if they happen to be listening to this, and I wish they would, is that one of the things with cults is that there's an inconsistency with what they teach and what they do. And the main teaching, I've heard you talk about this in your podcast, and it's a great thing you pointed out, is that we were taught is that there's no victims. And now there is a victim, and that is Keith Raniere, and he's a victim to the justice system. And these women are victims to Sarah Edmondson and her false narrative. I mean, how in the hell can you have both things? You can't. Because if they were to really use the tools, they'd say, I would say to Nikki, how did you cause this? I'd say to Keith, how did you author this? How did you create this situation? We're part of a team that exposed it. We didn't cause it.
Yeah, no, they're saying that they're exposing the truth. It's like the truth's already been exposed, guys.
Yeah, they just
don't
want to see
it. That's what this whole thing was. And the only reason they would listen to this podcast is because they want to take our narrative and pick it apart and make it fit theirs. Robert, in one of your podcasts, you talked about how you showed up, I think, to when they were dancing.
Yeah.
And you asked a question about Keith Raniere, and they said,
I actually asked the phone. It's pretty funny. I called up, and the person on the phone, I believe, was Nikki Klein, according to people I spoke to. And I asked the question, and I asked, hey, is this any connection to Keith Raniere? And their response was not a response you would say if you had nothing to do. Like, you would say,
who
exactly. Are you talking about? Nexium, what's that? It wasn't well known at that point. So that was the giveaway. It was like there was like a press release type response just ready to come off to that. And then
100%.
Direct questions will never be answered directly. Like they will blur context, lie by omission.
Like they said in the NBC.
Change the narrative. They will do things that once they're cornered to answering a yes or no question. Like I saw someone ask him, do you think it's possible Keith did bad? Well, let's talk about bad. So they want to control the narrative, and that's gaslighting.
What does bad even mean? How do you know it's
when
bad?
When I went to Jim, when I told him, and I told him, I go, Sarah's been branded. you know, I looked him in the eyes, there was a flat affect. And that told me one of two things. He knew about it, right? He knew this was going on.
And I'm sorry, who is this?
This is Jim Del Negro, I assume.
He's one of Keith's right-hand mans. He either knew about it, right, which is a problem for me, or he didn't react to it appropriately, which is a problem for me, right? I just dropped a bomb on him that this is going on behind the scenes, and his first question is, well, what's the actual bad thing? And I just knew I was talking to a wall. You know, I just, you know, there's nothing I'm going to say or do that's going to change their narrative. They have to want to go on that journey. They have to want truth.
We're just going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
And we're back for another episode of NXIVM on Trial. I'm Casey Seiler, joined by our reporter, Rob Gavin, as well as Sarah Edmondson and her husband, Anthony Ames, also known as Nippy. I wanted to ask, this is something that came up in the recent piece that Barry Meyer of the New York Times did, sort of comparing the two recent cable docs on NXIVM, which was the idea that when sort of the break with NXIVM occurred, that there were kind of two modes of thinking about it. One, that NXIVM was an effective curriculum that unfortunately was created by a madman, and the idea that NXIVM was essentially rotten from its inception, that it was set up, organized, and kind of refined to be a hustle, to be a mind control technique. And I just wonder, do you come down on one side or another of that? In other words, is NXIVM good stuff that was perverted, or was it just wrong from the jump? And has your attitude on that question changed perhaps over the course of the last 3+ years?
I think you can make room for both. And here's why. I think there's good things out in the world that Keith stole, peddled as his own. And I think you could take a 5-day training, get some good stuff out of it, but I think you could get it anywhere else. Like you could get it out of a book. I've since found some areas where he literally stole
word
examples
for word.
Almost verbatim. There's a book called Power vs. Force by David Hawkins. And I can pick 3 modules out of there almost identical to what he did. And it's powerful stuff. So if you haven't seen this stuff before, and I was 26 when I first did it, I thought, wow, this really gets you to think about stuff. I think Keith has an itch that he can't not scratch. And I think he couldn't get it through honest means, never could at an early age. And then I think that coupled with his narcissistic sociopathic tendencies, create his curriculum pretending to be a guru or whatever, but that gave him power and allowed him to abuse people. So I think you could have gone to it, not seen a lot of that for a long time. And I think the closer to Keith you got, the more damaged you got. Seduced is somewhat the obvious documentary to make. You bring in the experts, you bring in the people, you come in with a thesis that Keith, this is all bad, and you get the experts and everyone to say so.
It's the star series in the Oscar.
Yeah. And there's room for that. The vow is one that takes it at least attempts to give its subjects dignity and help people understand how and why something this has happened, and gives people. Listen, one of the reasons this in conjunction with why we did the podcast, 99% of the people that signed up for this thing, good people and wanted to do good, and we're doing good. I think the further away from Keith you got, like if you came to Vancouver or you went to the Mexico City Center, you had people showing up doing their goals with probably a little bit of poison curriculum. Like I'm a firm believer that if you look at companies, a company's going to take on the personality of their CEO the same way a sports team takes on the personality of their coach. So ultimately, Keith was at the top of this, and his poison was, and his thumbprints were on everything to a certain degree, at least in the abusive realm. And that's unavoidable for everyone who came through. It's just case by case.
Just to add one thing to that, and I won't go into more detail because I think he answered that very thoroughly, but I do think in answer to the question, I do believe it was poison from the beginning. It wasn't a good curriculum with good intentions that went awry. It was always the plan. I've heard that Keith spent a lot of time at a yoga community where he saw the leader being adored and was like, I want a piece of that, and decided to make this curriculum so he could be that, so he could be the guru. But so I think he planned it. Apparently he was planning DOS for over a decade, called the Blackmail MLM scheme, according to Kristen Keefe. This was always the plan, but was there good stuff? Unfortunately, yes. And it's been a big part of our healing journey, and also what we're going to talk about in the podcast is where did he steal those things from? All the good stuff that we got from it wasn't from him. He literally went through like Eckhart Tolle's books and basic Buddhist meditations and goals things and NLP and cobbled it together. What he did well was put it together in a way that if you were open, you could have big transformational shifts because your mind was super open and you were really wanting to grow. And in that process, he also slipped in some key modes for indoctrination, also known as brainwashing or re-socialization, so that you would be ripe and susceptible for more abuse should you continue. So
weaponizing it
effectively. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a question I had from you covering the trial and certainly watching The Vow is for both of you, but I guess starting with Sarah, you were very close, obviously, with Lauren Salzman. Obviously, you know, your experience in DOS, it's very emotional the way it's talked about on the show. But Sarah, as we all know, you are the whistleblower. And at trial, Lauren became the devastating witness against Keith Raniere. What do you think about her? I mean, obviously you were friends, she betrayed you, and then she obviously then betrayed Keith. Is there any relationship there? Is there any room for a relationship? What do you think when you think of Lauren Salzman? What is she to you now?
You know, it's changed a lot over the years. I was very angry for a period. I felt so much betrayal. I couldn't feel much more than that. After the trial and her public apology and her waking up, in essence, I feel a lot of empathy for her, actually. You know, I've had zero contact. I would like to at some point. Nippy feels differently, but it's, we actually talk about that in the first episode of our podcast. I would like to have closure. I'd like to have face-to-face, but I feel like she didn't sign up for this. None of us signed up for this. And that's ultimately, you know, I do see her as a victim, but I also feel like she does need to be held accountable. I'll leave that up to the judge. But I kind of wish I could give her a big hug. I hope she's healing. I hope she's reading all the cult recovery books and leading a normal, healthy life.
Nippy, how do you feel? Obviously, it's come out, obviously, that you don't feel quite that same way.
You know, I mean, I've cooled off since, you know, I had a camera on me during one of the more trying times of my life. You know, I think ultimately time heals a lot of things, and empathy will, if you're empathetic, will take over. The one delineation that I have a real hard time wrapping my head around is they knew Keith Raniere's character, and they lied to a volume and a lot of people to keep them loyal, knowing that he wasn't who he said he was. And I say they, I say Nancy as well. And I think Lauren knew if I'd seen who Keith really was, I'd have been out of there. And, you know, you're either serving your community or you're getting your community to serve you. And to me, the effects of having everyone loyal to Keith, which is really to serve her and what she was doing, destroyed some people's lives permanently. Sarah and I, you know, it's temporary. We're going to be okay. We're working and, you know, we're getting help. And we had a lot of people there waiting for us to help us. But I don't think there's going to be a time where we sit and have coffee and remember that time we were in a cult together. I just, you know, I'm not there, you know, and, you know, not because I'm angry, just because I need to preserve my space, my energy. I can't give that any more of my time. And that's where I am right now. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't judge it. I'm just being honest with how I think and feel about it. But, you know, we underestimated a lot of people's capacity to lie to us, and that damaged our lives immensely. And I never used my psychology at any point during this whole thing. when people left and were talking about, you know, Keith to go after people. And it got back to us that, you know, she was talking a lot of, can I cuss?
He was going to cuss.
Yeah. She was talking a lot of shit about us, you know,
she like, was saying,
you
know, that we were going to go to jail.
We were getting what we deserved, you know, slandering our character to our former friends. And, you know, I just, you know, I'm not hugging anyone that was doing that to me, you know, anytime soon, you know. And I don't know where her psychology is on it. You know, I know she did the right thing in the trial, and good for her. But, you know, that's just where I am.
When the sentencings come up, Warren, obviously Nancy Salzman, Kathy Russell, and Allison Mack all have to be sentenced still. Do you have any thoughts toward Warren and Nancy, and obviously Allison Mack's sentencing as well? What do you think the punishment should fit the crimes in their case?
Look, I think the scarlet letter that they have to wear for the rest of their lives is punishment enough. That doesn't mean they shouldn't do some time if they're not contrite in what they've done. So I don't know. It's hard to say. I think part of the reason Claire Bronfman got such a stiff sentence is the judge looked at her and said, this girl doesn't get it.
Yeah, she needs more time in prison to get it.
You know, and if Nancy and Lauren roll into the courthouse with that attitude, they deserve time to go, and if you can, it's difficult to ascertain how genuine someone is in those situations, but if they're remorseful and they recognize what they've done and they recognize how they damaged people, then, you know, that reconciliation is hard enough. And I don't know, sitting in a jail cell is going to help them reconcile it any more than maybe they already have.
I wanted to point out, and I know when we were talking earlier, there's this, you know, narrative among the remaining loyalists to Keith Raniere about you, Sarah, but the reality is you never testified at trial. So, I mean, the jury heard all that evidence without hearing a word from you and convicted him. Regardless of what you were saying, they heard and saw a lot of evidence from various people in the case. So I think that's interesting that you could take you completely out of it and he's still convicted and sentenced to 120 years in prison. And at that trial, of course, being a part of The Vow, it was the second season, I believe, right? I mean, what can you talk about? Is there anything you talk about the second season or how the first season has affected you? Like, what is it like to now be in your shoes a year later? Like a year ago, you obviously had a book, you had come forward in the New York Times, but now you've been on this huge show on HBO. So what's it like now to be you in After the Vow season one?
I mean, honestly, it's been a massive roller coaster because before it came out, we didn't know how it was going to be perceived. And, you know, I've been an actor for 20 years. I've never really been recognized for any of the work that I've done. And I've realized that maybe I should just be myself from now on because the recognition that we've gotten for what we did and how we helped, you know, expose Keith is honestly, it's really validating. And I don't want to say vindicating because the whole thing is so sad overall, but it's not like, yes, we won, but it's more like, thank goodness the world has this information now, because I was 27 when I got in. My thoughts on cults were very different than what I think now about cults. And I want, you know, everyone to have this template so they know what it looks like so that it can avoid the pitfalls or get out. And I'll tell you the thing that in terms of what it's like to be me now, and I think Nippy's experience is a little different, but I get messages every day from around the world saying, I've seen The Vow, and either thank you, thanks to you, I got out of a program, which I've now found out is a cult because I saw the red flags thanks to The Vow, or B, I was able to help a family member, or C, you know, it helped to explain this thing that happened to me 10 years ago with a narcissist. I didn't know what it was. I'm talking daily, and during The Vow, hundreds of messages. So, you know, like I said at the beginning, I like helping people, and now I get to actually do it in something that's legitimate. And
actually set out to do and achieve what we set out to do.
Yeah. It's a bit of a twisted road. Right. But you know, people drive by us. Like one woman drove by me the other day and was like, you're so brave. And somebody stopped Nippy on the street and goes, Nippy, I respect you.
Yeah.
You know, like nobody said anything bad to us. There's like, you know, I probably had like 10 negative troll messages.
I had like one.
Yeah. Not compared to the thousands of positive. It's really rewarding and meaningful and uplifting. And I feel really good about what we did. I'm really glad that we went public and we told our story. And at the same time, it's bizarre because like the teachers at my son's school know the story and my neighbors who before that just thought I was an actress.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's a weird type of like vulnerability that they've seen like the darkest, most traumatic time of my life. But they also know who I am, which is kind of cool and like what I'm made of. So that's neat.
Yeah, Robert, I like to go back to a point you just made about Sarah wasn't even in the trial. She didn't even have to testify. Yet it seems to be, she seems to be the target of these people in here. And to me, it only reveals their real intent, right? Because I think, you know, I read something recently, if you go down the road of revenge, be sure to dig a grave for two. And I think what they're doing is revenge against Sarah. They feel wronged by her and they're pretending to do it under these noble terms and pretending to be this altruistic group that understands something that we don't get. Because when all the information came out, Sarah and I's story was peripheral to the actual real abuse, right? So if there's anyone's claims that you want to refute, it's not Sarah's. I think Sarah's the one who's the popular one, and they don't like that, and they want to take that down. And that actually reveals their real intent and their real character that they're hiding, or think they're hiding. And when I started this, it's an insult to everyone's intelligence because they think they're hiding this from us and we don't see it. And their narrative breaks down under 3 to 4 direct questions. So while it's frustrating to be on the other end of it, I'd hate to be where they are. I'd hate to be in that prison because they're in a prison and they're digging their own graves with that. So that's a sad story in its entirety. Yeah, it's frustrating to be on the other end of it. So
you mentioned prison, and obviously Keith Raniere is serving 120 years in prison. He recently was moved to Tucson, Arizona. Any thoughts about that?
Well, you understand the conversations that have happened over the last 3 or 4 years and abuses and pain that happened over the last 20 plus 30 are an effect of one person, really, and a myth of one person. And that person and that myth is locked away where it can't hurt anyone else anymore. And I feel proud. I feel, relieved that we have a system in place. And I participated in facilitating him being taken in out of society in the way that it did. One of the things I bet large on when this thing happened was once the cards were on the table, and someone, the jury of the peers, was going to see what was going on, they were going to see this guy for who he really was. And I didn't know how in the right we were because we didn't know all the abuses. All that stuff started coming out in the trial. And that actually was one of the more traumatizing things, to think that this stuff was going on right underneath our noses the whole time. But if this was a card game or a sports game, it was a blowout. They didn't even get a punch off. Like that, it wasn't even close. We were playing with a full house and they had jack high, and it wasn't remotely close, once the cards were on the table. So that was a relief. And to the swiftness in which he was taken out of society was pretty impressive. I mean, when this thing happened, I thought, oh my God, this is gonna be the next 5 to 10 years of my life. And the fact that he was arrested in March of 18 and under a year, and he was in jail, to me is like, you can say a lot of things are being said about the FBI and how they work, but they got this one right.
Sarah, any final thoughts that you have as well? And I will actually ask if you could mention when your podcast begins. I didn't ask you the beginning
sure.
of that too.
It actually launches on Monday, so I'd love people to subscribe. And we called it a little bit culty because, we admitted that our group was, that Nexium was a little bit culty, but we didn't realize it was an actual cult. And part of our podcast is to help people understand what's the difference between something, so that's a little bit culty, to like, no, you need to get out of this thing. My final thoughts, when you asked if we wanted to talk about this, I remember that Keith used to say, and he never responded to any of the media that you guys put out, because he would say, never wrestle with a pig, because if you wrestle with a pig, you both get dirty, but the pig likes it. In this case, you know, Times Union's the pig, right? So I think that was part of me, like, I'm not going to dignify their accusations with a response. I'm like, fuck that. Excuse my language. That's Keith talking. I'm going to respond because I have an opinion about this, and you can take it or leave it. And the other thought I wanted just to wrap up with is that one of the things that planted a seed for me, and I wrote about this moment in my book, is that a couple months or maybe a year before I left, a friend of mine sat down with me, her husband, because he was concerned about her participating in the program. And he basically showed me all the articles. And I was just like, Pepe, this is like, it's just a smear campaign. Like everything I'd been taught to say is all smear campaigns, all smear campaign. And he's like, sir, do you understand how the media works? Like they can't fabricate everything. Like what if even 10% of this is true? And I didn't wake up then, but it planted a seed for me to go, huh, right. Okay. So like all the things that had been written about him, what if even 10% of that was true? Well, what would that mean to me? I was still too indoctrinated to at that point, but I actually have a question for you that I'm hoping that you can answer. And keeping in mind that when we were in, we'd been told that, you know, Times Union was doing all this smear campaign and they were so unethical and blah, blah, blah. And at one point I remember Claire Bronfman coming into a meeting. I don't think you were there, Nippy, and saying, she was so relieved because she had on camera, I don't know if it was the editor or somebody saying and admitting that they made it all up to,
oh my God,
to take them down to, basically she'd gone in to interview somebody and they had somebody on their deathbed, maybe like somebody who was dying of cancer or something. Does this sound familiar? Like a high up person at the Times Union?
No.
No,
this is a new
okay,
one.
Okay, no, okay, all right.
New one on us.
Okay, so forgive me because I don't remember exactly, but I remember her saying that she'd gone in with Mark Vicente. Maybe Mark would have more on this. Filmed him admitting on his deathbed that it was all untrue and it was all a smear campaign. And this, she was so happy because this was going to vindicate us and prove that we were under attack. Blah blah blah. Then later, the footage was lost. So yeah
really
right
yeah. The footage was lost, and but I remember like every time she'd always be late for whatever we're doing. She'd be talking to lawyers and having meetings and fighting against whatever was happening, and every now and then she kind of like it was always very top secret, but that was something she shared with, like, I don't know if it was me or us, it was a small group.
Yeah, that's like saying, well, oh yeah, I, you know, I did once own the Holy Grail, but I lost it, you know.
Yeah. And now the person died. Was there somebody that died that was a high up person, like an editor that wasn't
I'm
you?
Trying to picture being on your deathbed and you're like, oh, I love my relatives. I love you. Hey, by the way, we brought down Keith Raniere unnecessarily.
Yes, like, I really appreciate a representative of the organization that we've been reporting on so assiduously
dropping
by my deathbed to interview me. No,
You've been an editor for a while, right?
I've been at the paper for 20 years, Rob.
I've been there 15 years.
Yeah.
Going back to when
Dennis Bisco
was covering it. I'm just trying to think. I don't know anybody who passed away who would have, you know, I know there was a time years ago where Claire Bronfman came in and meet with, I think she met with George.
George Hurst, our publisher, yeah. And Greg Smith as well. But that meeting very quickly devolved into Keith dropping nostrums and, you know, running his rap, and George very quickly sort of recognized that this was not going to be very beneficial. But I mean, Sarah, the truth of the matter is that the Times Union's reporting on NXIVM, rather than anybody, you know, revealing in some stunning way that we had made it all up, has stood up to the, you know, to the test of time. It certainly stood up. I mean, all of those stories were lawyered to a fare thee well by very good attorneys. And there's been nothing, including in the federal attention that's been paid to this, that has knocked down any of the reporting in those stories. You know?
Oh no, we know that.
Yeah, all right. But I'm just saying, you would think if there was some kind of deathbed confessional,
right.
It would have come out by now.
I thought you'd appreciate that story though.
No, right? It's a great story
I love it.
It's similar to what it came out during the testimony of, you know, Edgar Bronfman's former attorney. He testifies that the questions Claire and her sister had asked, like Claire had no knowledge. She basically had no knowledge of how things worked. If you look back at the testimony, they thought, oh, well, you know, you, you know, Bill Clinton, can you just go get a you know, criminal case against these people? Like, she really had no clue how things worked. And she thought that she could get the Times Union to stop writing stories. And she thought a number of things, according to, you know, the testimony of that attorney. But the proof in this case would not be necessarily in the pudding, but in the boxes in Nancy Salzman's basement, where Times Union employees and publishers and editors were on the enemies list of NXIVM.
All right. Well, thanks once again for listening to another episode of NXIVM on Trial. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Thanks as well once again to the subscribers who sustain our investigative journalism. Please check back in for future episodes of NXIVM on Trial, as well as the Times Union's other companion podcasts, including Capital Confidential and The Eagle.